Last week, we stood together on the banks of the Jordan River and watched John the Baptist stand there in those waters and plunge Jesus into them. And this week, as we stand on the banks of those waters again, what if we took our eyes off of Jesus just for a moment? And we looked around at the crowd gathered there on the banks of those waters. Perhaps we might notice a young boy just standing a few feet from us. That he's from one of those surrounding villages in the Jordan Valley. He had come out for several days, coming to hear about this fiery and passionate preacher and prophet, John the Baptist, who was inclined to speak honestly, challenging others, even when the religious authorities came from the city gates of Jerusalem to hear him. That for a small town boy, it was must-see TV. That he stood there enthralled by what was happening. That there is John the Baptist standing waist deep in that river like he's Moses leading the people of God across the Red Sea. Speaking loudly for everyone to hear. Raising his hand in the air and pronouncing the faithfulness of God. And then plunging people into those waters. And this young boy knew the long tradition of ritual baths in Judaism, especially for priests. It was a way to honor God, an outward symbol of one's inner heart. But this seemed a little different to him. This was far from the sanctuary of the temple. It was somewhat outside of the chain of command. There was less ceremony to it. It was up close and personal. It was out there in the wilderness where daily life takes place. And then on this particular day, a man named Jesus walked slowly into those waters next to John. And the boy could see John's face looked different. Like he didn't know what to do. And you could see the two men whispering to one another. Everyone on the banks wondering what they were talking about. That John turned to Jesus and said, I can't baptize you. You need to baptize me. And then finally, John relented and plunged Jesus into those waters. And that young boy knew something was different about that day. It's like discovering the presence of Christ in our midst, right there in the middle of the ordinary. As Paula de Arcy writes, God comes to you disguised as your life. The Gospel of John certainly looks at the life of Jesus differently. That it's written much later than Matthew, Mark, or Luke. And it is presumed that most people knew the Jesus story by that point. So the Gospel of John wanted to deepen and widen people's understanding of it. So when the Gospel of John starts to tell the story of Jesus, he doesn't begin right there with Jesus' baptism like the Gospel of Mark does. He doesn't even reach back and start the story of Jesus' life by telling the story of Jesus' birth, like Matthew and Luke do. Instead, the Gospel of John reaches all the way back to the very beginning of creation itself, talking about the presence of Christ there for the birth of new life. And now we are given life anew through that same power of love, that we discover the presence of Christ right there in the world around us. It would be like if a well-known celebrity walked into your birthday party. There you are, hunched down, hovered over that cake, trying to make the best of your wish for that year. And you go to blow out the candles on the cake, and you look up. What is Tom Hanks doing in Auburn? We've only seen him from a distance up there on the big screen, you know, on that castaway island, holding up a volleyball, yelling the name Wilson. Or discovering that he's got mail. But now, he's there in the room with us. How much more are we shocked to discover the presence of Christ, the power of love that brought all of God's goodness into creation, right there in the room with us. Well, two of John the Baptist's disciples found this hard to believe. They could not make sense of all of this. So when Jesus comes walking by one day and asks them what they are looking for, they are unable to articulate an answer. So Jesus simply says, "Come and see," that they discover, along with us, that life, many times, is more than we expect. And the fancy word for this is transcendence. It's brushing up against something more, encountering the Spirit of God right there in the room with us. And it instills in us such humility. As Bradley Rigger writes, if our religion is too small, it easily shrinks into a closed little cult. That if our God is too narrow, it resists loving others outside the circle. And if our learning is too limited, it will not endure the complexities of our living. That there is a long and ancient history of people discovering a God whose power works in a larger direction. A God who frees people, who loves people, who redeems in the midst of ugliness. That transcendence reminds us how big God really is, and what the power of love can do. And it is almost indescribable. It's like the young person off at a church retreat. It's always good to get away, to spend time with friends, to talk about the things that truly matter, to get away from all of that measuring up and constant comparison of high school that is the air that we breathe in those hallways. During that time in our lives, we're trying to become comfortable in our own skin, to discover the importance of our own lives. And it's there, sitting on the banks of a calm river, looking out how it's completely flat, away from the constant noise of everyday life, that she hears the stillness of God. And to her surprise, it is in that stillness that she feels the deepest purpose and passion of her life. Or it's like the couple who's been planning their wedding for months, thinking about all of the details in those last few weeks, worried about checking off that to-do list, and then the weekend finally arrives. They're so excited to have all of their friends and family together in the same room that they cannot wait to walk through those doors of the reception and to enjoy the company of loved ones with food and dancing and music. That they've thought less about the ceremony. Those details were finalized weeks ago. That is, until that moment of standing there in the front of the room, shoulder to shoulder, face to face, there in front of the congregation and the presence of God, they're surprised. Because they find it hard to say those vows out loud. Not because they aren't ready, but because they realize how sacred and important they are. Or it's like the summer that I worked as a chaplain in the hospital and seminary. The days were rather predictable. You would go up to your assigned floor and print out the list of patients and walk from room to room, knocking on those big, heavy wooden doors and introducing yourself to patients and family and just sitting and getting to know them. The nights, though, were a little more unpredictable. They gave you this little beeper, and you'd walk down this long gray hallway at the far end of the hospital where it seemed as if no one had been before. And you went through this room to the on-call space where there was a nice comfy chair and bed that you knew you wouldn't use that night. Because as soon as you sat down, the beeper always went off. And I was called one evening to a room where a patient had been receiving palliative care, that the doctors had done all that they were able to do, and now they were keeping him comfortable. And the room was full of family. So many of them, it made the room feel rather small. And I introduced myself to several of them and talked with them. And then I just found a seat over in the back corner of the room. And sitting there in that space with that family that I did not know well, I knew, though, there were stories of beautiful commitment, stories of family being family to one another, of laughing together around the table, of traditions at the holidays. But I also knew there were stories of frustration and heartache, as there are in every family. But there in that space, they had gathered around their loved one for what truly mattered. And then, in a way I cannot describe, after months of long battles and days of constant suffering, their loved one took his last breath. And in the midst of the tears and sadness, the real heartache that gripped the family, in a way I cannot explain, there was also this stillness in the room. where you knew that God's presence was there with them. Life and faith is more than we expect. That's why the psalmist says, God placed a new song in my mouth. But that is not where the psalmist begins. The psalmist begins by saying, I cried out. I waited patiently for the Lord. And in that patience, there's all that struggle and doubt, confusion and anxiety, exhaustion and worry. But somewhere in the midst of it, we might brush up against God's presence. As John Claypool reminds us, God's other name is surprise. Martin Luther King Jr. tells the story from the protest in Montgomery that one of the finest civil rights leader there was a woman affectionately known as Mother Pollard, that despite her age and health, she walked and marched for days. Someone asked her one evening, Mother Pollard, are you tired? And she said, my feet are tired, but my soul is rested. One night after King had had a particularly hard week of life-threatening phone calls and time in jail, he was speaking at a meeting one night, trying to, as he says, show this outward sense of courage and strength when inside he felt despair and sadness. And as he walked down from the pulpit that evening, Mother Pollard met him afterwards and said, what is wrong? He said, nothing. Everything's fine. And standing there looking up at him, she said, you cannot fool me. I know something is wrong. She said, I told you, we are with you every step of the way. But even if we weren't, God is going to take care of you. And in a way that King cannot explain, he says, when he heard those words, everything in him quivered and quickened. That those words kept speaking to him in all the days to come. That we cannot explain it, but we just might be surprised by the presence of God right there in the room with us. As Jesus said to all of us, come and see. Amen.